You're up there.
Is that working? Higher, lower? We're good? Okay. I haven't mastered the art of lapel mics yet, so. Next on the list. But, yeah, it's great to be here. I try to be here, I guess, most Sunday mornings, but this is, a different view of what I normally get. Paul asked me to speak quite a while back, and sometimes it's one of those things where you just have no idea what you are going to talk on. I think the shorter notice is the better notice, but I procrastinate a lot. No, but this was great. I was just kind of thinking more on this along the line of this theme of just kind of Christ's servanthood and just the humility that he, like, not that he was able to be humble, but like he was humility and just how he acted. But I think C.S. Lewis says, as soon as one talks about humility, it often leaves the room. And I think it's a hard thing to, I mean, I could be up here talking about how humble I am, but the point would not come across. But as I was just trying to understand more and more of how, it's just not an easy task to be this embodiment of humility. But I think what made the most sense to me was, last week, we were just at a conference at Rockridge Canyon in Princeton for Young Life with team leaders, all staff, national staff, and a few leaders. And there was just one quote that came up from, another one from C.S. Lewis, where he chronicles Narnia. People are familiar with it. And the last one, there's this scene where Lucy, the main character, is looking for the god character, which is Aslan. And he's this big lion, portrayed as a lion. And she's running through the woods, and she finds him, and they have this beautiful relationship that runs many years. But once Aslan looked to her, and she actually found her, Lucy says, "Aslan, you're bigger." And Aslan says, "That is because you are older, little one." "Not because you are," said Lucy. "I am not, but every year you grow, you will find me bigger." And something with that just kind of resonated with me, where Lucy just had this constant pursuit of God and wanting to know more and more and get closer and closer. And every year, as she just matured in her faith, God just profoundly became bigger and bigger in her life. Where I think, on the contrast, if we don't pursue God, we can definitely find that God can become smaller and smaller in our lives. But once I kind of was thinking about that, it was almost this idea of, if God continues to become bigger in our lives, maybe humility can, become easier as we go. But it is a difficult thing. But one other thing from Lewis, he says that humility, just so we can have a bit of a definition, he says it's not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. And I really appreciated that, just because it kind of clarifies it for me a little bit more of, not thinking less of myself, but just thinking of myself less. Quick little story of a humbling time in my life. Tim will like this. It includes baseball. I thought of you. Is my brother and I, we grew up playing baseball, and we loved it. I still do. Don't really pursue it actively on television, but if anyone wants to go throw a ball, I'm happy to do it. But as we were growing up from teens, I mean, like, when you could walk, we were throwing balls and stuff. But later in our high school years, we were on these more advanced teams, and one day we won this game, and it took us to this national, like, we were on the national stage. So we were playing against all the provinces, and it was, to win the national. So and this is, I get confused. A lot of people say baseball here when they do the softball. We don't do that back in New Brunswick. Anyway, baseball. So, I had to clear, it's strange sometimes. But anyway, I was a pitcher, and I loved it. It was just kind of, I was one who was awkward, but at the same time, the game almost revolves around the pitcher. If the pitcher doesn't throw the baseball for the batter to hit, there's no game. So there's a lot of pressure, and I'm not one for pressure, but It kind of sunk in this one game. We were against Newfoundland, and we're on this national stage in Ontario, and there's scouts watching you. There's all these different, there's television, all this stuff is there. And of course, I'm pitching, and I had a great time. But I was throwing really well, and I had a pitch called a knuckleball, which some people know. You throw it, you don't grip the ball how you normally would, but you just throw it with the tips of your fingers, and it doesn't spin. It just kind of like shakes and goes. So you never throw it twice the same, basically. And it's kind of a rare pitch to throw, but I just kind of loved the idea of it when I was younger, so I just worked and worked and worked on it. And the game was going great. Our team was playing super well. We ended up finishing the game, and I threw what's called a one-hitter, where only one person actually got on base that entire game. So it was, for me, I'm like, man, I am killing it right now. Like, I am so good at this. And it was amazing. We won the game, and then I was speaking with scouts, I was speaking with universities, all these things afterwards, and it was kind of cool. And of course, like, I'm blowing up a little bit, and blowing up a little bit. And then the next day, we go back to like the stadiums where everyone's playing, and there's a picture of me right on the front page, like throwing the ball, and it's just like, yeah, of course, like why wouldn't there be a picture? But then our next game was against British Columbia that day, and of course it's just like, Josh, you're getting right back in there and you're doing the exact same thing, and I'm just like, well, of course, like easy. But I was goofing off, and I remember like catching the ball with my throwing hand, like putting a little glove on, like a little kid's glove. And I ended up catching the ball and hit my finger, and it just went completely fat. And I was just like, wow, I cannot move my hand that I throw the ball with. And the game starts in about 20 minutes. So I was like, coach, I can't go in. But of course, his mind is, you're going in there and doing the exact same thing. But anyway, I went in there, and by the first inning, I was just throwing as hard as I could and the best as I could, but it just was not right because I couldn't bend this finger. And then sure enough, bases are loaded, and sure enough, before the first inning's over, a grand slam is hit off me, and then it all goes downhill from there. I'm benched. And it was just this moment of me realizing that it wasn't about me, it was about this team, but I really made it about me, and I don't think I'll try not to ever do that again, because it was on that stage to have the biggest game you've ever done, followed by the worst game you've ever done, is, yeah, it hit you. But that's kind of this, I think we come into those checks of humility every now and then. But we're with Jesus, as we'll see in John 13, that he just portrays it. He lives it. And I'll just get into it. And it was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that at the time had come for him to leave this world and go to his Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. So we just have this picture painted of the Passover, which for Jesus, it was his death was very close. I'm sure that was on his mind, but I love how it says at the end that he now showed them the full extent of his love. And I think that's just important to highlight is that who here has a bad day once in a while? I know I do, and I know when I have a bad day, things definitely want to revolve around myself. But here, Jesus is, he has the weight of humanity about to crush him in a few days, and yet he just actively wants to love and serve his disciples to the fullest of extent. And so the evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal and took off his outer clothing and wrapped the towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. So now John makes a note that Judas has been tempted. And Jesus is well aware of it. And I think it's pretty amazing that Jesus recognized what the act that Judas is about to do, but yet just willingly and servantly wants to wash his feet in this great act of love. And I don't know, I kind of was thinking more on that. And there's people in our lives that sometimes we rub up the wrong way against, or they Maybe we know that we don't get along the best, or that they don't get along the best with us, and sometimes we know we're going to be in the same situation, and defenses, our guards might come up a little bit before we actually even get there, because we know what that person's like, they know what we're like, but we want to have our guard up. We want to be sometimes the first one to strike before they do. But here Jesus is, again, full well knowing the circumstances that Judas is tempted with, and he just wants to actually get on his knees before him and wash his feet. In verse 3, John highlights that Jesus does what God does and under his power. And we are reminded of this in John 5:19, as Jesus says that he does what he sees the Father doing. And that's pretty amazing, because if Jesus does what he sees the Father doing, what he sees God doing, washing feet is pretty mind-blowing to myself. Not that God is saying, wash my feet, but let me wash your feet. And it just, for me, it paints this beautiful picture of who God is. In the next two verses, Jesus begins the preparation of washing his disciples' feet, something quite shocking for a master to be doing. So in that time, as some Google context would tell you, it was very common for Gentile slaves to be the ones washing the feet of their masters. Sometimes you would have wives wash the feet of husbands, and children would wash the feet of their parents, and disciples would wash the feet of teachers. And his disciples would understand that context pretty clearly. But then to have Jesus, who is their teacher, and who they're piecing it together that he is Christ, all of a sudden take that towel and get down on the floor, they're mind blown. They're shocked. They're uncomfortable. They're extremely uncomfortable with it. Peter especially. I'll just read verse 6 here. It says, he came to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And this isn't a crazy reaction, I don't think, from Peter, to see all of a sudden Jesus get down and approach Peter to wash his feet. So I would say, yeah, that approach is very natural. Maybe a couple weeks ago, payday came around, so it's the big grocery day, and then I got a message from Allie, who just all of a sudden was just like, hey, someone paid for our groceries at the grocery store. And that's amazing, and I was like, well, why? That was the first question, and it was just like, oh, he tries to do something like that every day. I was like, well, how much were the groceries? And it was well over $100, and it was just something where I was kind of stuck in that, like, that's amazing. We just saved some money, first thing I noticed. But it was just this act of, like, why would this person do it? And then I thought, if it was me in that situation, almost the same situation that Peter's in, is that sometimes we just do not want to accept a gift, especially... Maybe, there could be a lineup, and I know if I was there, I would think, well, maybe I'm looking a little more like a weaker person, or why, yeah, just this uncomfortable act, this awkward moment of actually saying, like, sure, you put your card in the slot, and away you go. And I think Peter kind of actually, like, well, I know we don't really want sometimes to express that help, and my dad's I'm the worst for it, my dad's the best for it, where he calls me all the time, he's like, do you need money? And I say, no. And then I kind of look at the truck bills that we just put into it, and I'm like, well, I kind of do, but I don't want to just ask them. So maybe after this I'll apply it and ask them for some money afterwards. But but I think Peter's kind of in that mindset where it's like, there's no way, I can't accept this from you. And I'll just continue 7-8. And Jesus replied, you do not realize now what I'm doing, but later you will understand. No, said Peter, you shall never wash my feet. And you do not realize now what I'm doing, but later you will understand. I think it's just very common. Jesus is continually pointing to the cross, where his disciples just are still a bit ambiguous to it. A lot of cryptic words that they're trying to piece together. But then again, Peter just says, no, you'll never wash my feet. And Jesus goes on to say, unless I wash you, you have no part in me. So again, we see Peter putting up that defense, like, this is awkward, you shouldn't do this. And then Jesus says, it goes on. It says, Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part in me." Then Lord, Simon Peter replied, "Not just my feet, but my hands and my head, as well." So as soon as Jesus says, "Unless I wash you, you have no part in me," Peter gets very excited. He jumps to the opportunity. And then, kind of doing a little more research, the Greek word for part in this context is, I believe, is pronounced meros, which is meaning to share in one's inheritance. So as soon as Christ says that, as soon as Jesus says, "You have no part in me," Peter's just like, yes, do everything. Wash my feet, wash my hands, and wash my head. And it's pretty common, I think. Peter's very human for this, but he portrays these two kind of mindsets, I think, that actually keep us from being genuinely humble. And first we see Peter refusing a gift from Jesus because he feels he shouldn't receive it, or he's not worthy of it. I think that's a common thing we see when a lot of people is almost, it's labeled this worm theology, where we're just not good enough. Like, this is an amazing gift of grace can be offered to us, but we just feel so deep down that we are just not worthy of it. And Peter kind of portrays a bit of that. Then we see that once he understands that he can be a part of Jesus, he doesn't want to just accept that gift, but he demands more. And he just misses that. Jesus is displaying humility at his feet in front of him. And then Peter says, "Well, not just this gift, but give me more, and give me more." And both attitudes that Peter displays, I feel, are not that shocking. It seems that today, inside and outside of the church, many people do find themselves not deserving of God's grace. And just, they're not worth it. And then on the flip side of that, we have a lot of people who definitely wrestle with the idea that God isn't giving them what they deserve. So there's almost those two mindsets of first Peter says, "I'm not deserving of this," and then he flips around and says, "Well, if you're going to give this, then give me more than what you're expecting to give me." I think that either of those mindsets can just really leave no room to accept what that loving grace actually does for us. Like, just that drive of grace in someone's life. I strongly believe that if we are to live a life for God in humility, we must first fully accept God's ultimate gift of Jesus Christ. And through that love, such grace is recognized that if we truly accept it and believe it, it will humble an individual so greatly that they will feel a want and a need to selflessly serve those with them, and those around them. Not this, I have to, but this, almost you can't explain it, of I get to, I want to, kind of how Jesus is displaying that here. And I had a glimpse of this in my life where, I hope to have a glimpse of it all the time, but this one moment where, when I was 20, I was coming back. I was involved in a car accident, and it wasn't with another vehicle. It was with a moose. I don't know if people have seen a moose. They're not small. This one was no exception. But driving from St. John, New Brunswick, right on the coast, to where I went to university, is about an hour away, stretch of highway, about 100 kilometers. And just one night, just happened to change the song at the wrong time. I looked down, and when you looked up, there was a moose. Like, hey, my first moose I've ever seen. I'm no hunter, but I killed it, that's for sure. But this thing, it was quite dramatic. The thing came right in through the car windshield and crushed the whole front end of the car, and it was just this, I was blacked out, so I didn't know what really happened to that. But it was terrifying for myself. It happened very quick. But then maybe minutes later, I started to kind of come to, and it was just, again, midnight, quiet highway, no one was around. And you do your panic, your checklist of Kate, legs, work, all these things that are going on. But I was just remember looking around and being just completely crushed in this vehicle. And it took a little while, but then once I kind of calmed down, I just simply opened the door and walked out. And right in that moment, I just remember walking out, and I had a headache. It was, safe to say, I had a headache, but I just looked around and I was just, you know, starry night, so peaceful. And I just remember breathing and being like just overwhelmed by peace. And it was the weirdest thing because here's a horn that's stuck on, here's a moose on this side of the road, completely not alive, and no front end left of it, like completely written off. And I just had this peace. And it was pretty much, it was kind of like this, just this feeling of God saying, like, there's more for you. almost like you can't earn that love that I have for you, that grace that I've given to you. You cannot earn this. There's more for you. And that for me, it's not easy. It's a struggle every day to kind of remind myself of that. But it sticks with me. My neck reminds me most days that, oh yeah, that's right. God does have grace for me. Pastor and author Timothy Keller, he wrote a book called The Prodigal God, where he recalls a conversation with this lady who grew up in a church where she heard that God only accepted her if she was sufficiently good and ethical. Not that she was saved by sheer grace through the works of Christ rather than through her own works. And I understand this can still be a bit of a back and forth in church culture today. Is it works? Is it deeds? Is it both? However, that conversation can go. But as Pastor Keller told her that you're saved by sheer grace, like the grace of Christ, she said, that's a scary idea. It's a good scary, but it's still scary. And he asked her, what's so scary about unmerited free grace? And the woman replied, if I was saved by my good works, then there would be a limit to what God could ask of me or put me through. I would be like a taxpayer with rights. I would have done my duty, and now I deserve a certain quality of life. But if it is really true that I am a sinner saved by sheer grace at God's infinite cost, then there is nothing he cannot ask of me. And just thinking more about that and contemplating that, it seems like that is scary, that there's no limit to what God can ask of us, but it's amazing that God can ask from us. He can ask us to do things. And this lady could see immediately that the wonderful teaching of salvation by sheer grace had two edges. On one side, it cut away the slavish fear that God does freely, loves us freely despite our flaws and failures. As mentioned earlier, he's willing to wash our feet. Yet the lady also knew that if Jesus really had done this for her, she was not her own, that she was bought at a price. And I just kind of had a glimpse of that once I stepped out of that vehicle, that there was no denying that I was bought with a price and that there was nothing that God could ask me to do. Again, I need to remind myself of that daily, but it's just kind of this beautiful image that it's infinite what we can be asked to do. And it's a scary thing, but I'll continue on reading in verse 10. Jesus answered, "A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet. His whole body is clean, and you are clean, though not every one of you. For he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said not everyone was clean." Again, in that kind of cultural context, sandals were a big thing to wear. So if there's any kind of party happening, any kind of feast or gathering, kind of communal gathering, an individual could bath themselves, and it's pretty easy. But by the time you walk to that place with sandals, you're going to have muddy feet. So that's where this common idea was. It says the person in the bath only needs to wash their feet, where that's where this whole foot washing came in. But Jesus makes a comment. He says, "You are clean, though not every one of you," regarding to Judas, although none of his disciples are aware that Jesus actually means, or what he actually means, until later on in the chapter when Jesus gives him the piece of bread. In verse 12, when he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. "Do you understand what I have done for you?" he asked. I almost sat on that question of, do you understand what I have done for you? I think this raises a question. This is just a, maybe we can think about it ourselves sometimes as well, but Jesus just washed our feet, he cleansed us, and then he asks his disciples who are around him almost 24/7, who still seem to forget daily, but he says, do you understand what I have just done for you? Setting this example, cleansing you. I believe that cleansing is almost a foresight for the cross as well. But he's just asking them, just saying, do you understand what I've done for you? But yeah, I think even as people who aren't, like, we're not the 12 that were just following him daily who need a reminding of that. Do you understand what I've done for you? I think that's just something that we can contemplate on most days. In 13, Jesus affirms his identity to his disciples by saying that he is their teacher, and that is what they call him. The humility of Jesus is exemplifying his true humility, as he is indeed their teacher and Lord and Savior. He reminds them again that who he is while he's washing their feet. So again, it says in 13, you call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. And in verse 14 and 15, Jesus shifts from himself and his own example of humility that he's spelling out right in front of these people. And he says, now that I, your Lord, your teacher, your superior, your master, have washed your feet, you should wash one another's feet. And maybe that's confusing for the disciples. I know they might look around at their great friends and, you know, look at their feet, and they're probably not the prettiest things. I know my feet from snowboarding for 13 years aren't the prettiest things. But Jesus basically just says, right, he says, I've just set you this example, now wash one another's feet. And there's probably, I would be a little grossed out. I think maybe we'd look around to see who's the cleanest person. But some churches today actually do foot washing ceremonies. Has Pemberton Christian Fellowship ever done that? That's totally fine. I wouldn't be quick to do it, but and others don't. But in verse 15, Jesus, he doesn't say, because of this example I've shown you, you should do what I've done for you. He says, I have set you an example, a true, genuine, loving, humility example that you should do as I have done for you. Where Jesus is saying, this act of servanthood, this act of humility, do for others. I think we can get creative and not just think of washing feet, of how we can serve and embody Christ's humility around to each other in this church, but also around here in Pemberton and Whistler. But he just says very plainly, do this. In 16, he says, I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who has sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. Jesus is telling us that he is sent by the Father as he has been submissive to what the Father has asked him. And we, his disciples, are to be under the same authority of Christ, to do humbly what he asks. And in 17, he says, now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. And I just kind of, Jesus very speaks fairly cryptic, I think, to a lot of people in the Bible. But this is plain. This is very, very bold. He just says, now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. There's an unknown little quote that I found, but it says, the gospel is a life to be lived, not just an ideal to be contemplated. And for me, it's just, I was thinking about this, is how can we allow God to get bigger in our own lives to where that humility of no matter the pressures of our day, no matter what we have coming up in our agendas, no matter how gross people's feet are, or how, just look at that as how ugly the task may be to serve someone else, that we can get down on our hands and knees and set that example for those around us. Again, like I mentioned before, there's people in the church and there's people outside of the church who feel that they're just not worthy of it. But if someone was to come down with them to their level and actually pick them up while they're serving them, I think that could be life-changing. And I just wanted to end with that one last that idea again, that Lucy's conversation with Aslan, saying, "Aslan," Lucy said, "you're bigger." You can put that as God, "you're bigger." That is because you are older, little one," he answered. "Not because you are," said Lucy. "I'm not, but every year you grow, you will find me bigger." And again, just to think about this idea of, as we are pursuing God in daily, in his word and his prayer, that he's becoming larger for us, I think this act of servanthood kind of shifts that paradigm from, I have to do this for someone, to what a gift that through this grace that I've experienced, I get to do this for someone. And I think it would just be this amazing, the church does a great job, but to measure that, it's like there's still so much that can be done. And I think sometimes when we think there's so much that can be done, we make God smaller. But where we actually can pursue him and make God larger, humility would almost become just a natural part of our day. I just want to end on that in terms of the idea of what would it look like if we continually made God bigger in our own lives, and how can that humility come out. But I'll just end it with a prayer. But thank you, God, for your word and for just the example that you have plainly put out for us, that you, as Jesus Christ, as our Savior, you would get on your hands and knees and wash the feet of us who are far lesser. And I just thank you that you've come to meet all people where they're at, even those who are struggling with understanding your grace. Just help us as a church to understand that, to make you bigger every day, and to find new and better ways to wash the feet of those around us within our community. In your name we pray, amen.